Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, a weekly mix of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. On the show this week, a major report on climate, Skywatching the Green Flash, the science on human population growth and its impact to all living things here, and 13-year cicadas. Here's a scientist soundbite.
When the water's rising in the river and you're expecting a flood, you don't wait for absolute certainty on how high the river's going to rise. You go get the sandbags and you develop an evacuation plan. We have climate change occurring. We see significant risks in the future, and it's time to begin to make choices about how we're going to manage those risks.
You're listening to William Shimidas, Dean of the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. Dr. Shimidas was vice chairman of the Committee on America's Climate Choices, put together by the National Research Council and requested for by Congress on what the U.S. should do about climate change. Dr. Shimidas, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Jorge. Thank you.
Now, what are the main findings of the final report by the National Research Council, the National Academy of Sciences, on America's climate choices?
Well, there are a couple of important things. The first one I want to emphasize is one that some people might not see as being especially new, but I think is quite significant. You know, we spent about 2 years in this study over a period of time when some of the climate science was questioned in the media, in political arenas. And after those 2 years, with inputs from hundreds of experts, we concluded, confirmed that global warming is in fact occurring, that it is very likely due to human activities, and that the risks that we face as a result of global warming are quite significant. And on the basis of input that we had from economists and political leaders on both sides of the aisle, leaders in the private sector, community leaders, we felt that the risks are so severe that it warrants urgent action both to limit the emissions of global warming gases as well as to adapt to climate change. And our other finding, following up on that, is the best way to address these problems is through a process that we call risk management. We'll never know exactly what's going to happen in the future, so we should adopt a process that assesses the risks, develops options for addressing those risks, and is flexible so that those options and how we apply them can be changed as we learn more about the climate.
What are these risks that America, the U.S., faces from climate change?
Well, they range all the way from, I would say, water issues. You might be facing instances where you don't have enough water, where you have droughts. You might also be facing instances where you have floods. Some parts of the United States might actually experience from year to year one or the other, and we've already seen that occurring in parts of Texas and Oklahoma, in fact. We can expect to see impacts on agricultural production. We can see and expect to see greater heat waves and health effects from those. Certainly, a major effect that we're going to be seeing in the coming decades is sea level rise and the impact of sea level rise and greater storm intensity on coastlines and flooding.
Tell us about the evidence. What are the most important elements that went into this climate report? Where did the scientists get the information?
Well, as I mentioned a few seconds ago, we had inputs from hundreds of scientists and experts. We started out with a summit where we invited experts from around the world to tell us what they knew about climate. And we then went off and did our own investigations, looked at the literature, and on the basis of that came to our conclusions. There's so many, you know, important lines of evidence that tells us what's going on. For one, it's really clear the globe is warming. Not only do we have temperature records, we have melting ice. We have changes in seasons, earlier springs, later falls, and so forth. The fact that human activities are impacting the climate is really based on some of the most fundamental physics that we have, a law of thermodynamics called conservation of energy. If the atmosphere is heating up, extra energy is coming from somewhere. And over the past several decades, scientists have been trying to identify where that extra energy is coming from. We know now that it's not coming from the sun because we've been measuring the output from the sun for decades. We know it's not coming from the ocean. In fact, the oceans are heating up. And after searching and searching and searching, the only thing we're left with is that is coming from these extra greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere.
So this report, America's Climate Choices Report, it was asked for by the U.S. Congress on what should be done, you know, and I guess that's my question to you, Dr. Shimidas. What should be done right now or very soon about climate change?
We need to start taking action as quickly as possible to lower heat trapping gaseous emissions into the atmosphere. We call that, you know, mitigation or limiting climate change. The other really important part is adapting to climate change. The climate is already changing. Even if we were to cut emissions, increases in emissions today to zero, we would still be seeing continuing climate change, continuing warming. We're going to have to begin to adapt to those. So those two things are really important. We need to get started almost immediately.
Would you give us an example that the National Academy of Sciences found that is a good one in how to get started for the U.S. to deal with climate change?
There are a number of things that are already being discussed, like renewable portfolio standards. Many of the states are developing their own climate programs. We think long-term, the most effective way to get a handle on lowering emissions is to put what the expression is called, put a price on carbon, to increase the price of having to emit or pollute in the atmosphere by emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. The most effective way to do that, economists say, is through a market-based strategy, a cap and trade, for example. But a carbon fee or a carbon tax might work. But if we can send a signal to the marketplace and to people that there's going to be a cost associated with polluting the atmosphere, we believe, and many economists believe, that entrepreneurs and business people and corporations are going to begin to invest in new technologies to save money, to in fact make money by emitting less carbon. We call that a low carbon economy.
This carbon trading system has just really not worked so far in the United States. It really hasn't caught on. How do you feel as a scientist, maybe you could speak for the group of scientists at the National Academies, what is the feeling behind this, lack of response from people who can actually make this happen, policymakers, the Congress, in setting something up to take meaningful action on climate?
Well, of course, we're perplexed. And we're concerned about what we see as a lot of misinformation about the issue. But we were asked by Congress to develop a roadmap for America's climate choices that stretches out for decades. I suspect that the political environment in the United States is going to swing back and forth in lots of different directions in the coming years. And our report is really not aimed at any specific political party or political agenda, but is really developing and laying out a course of action for a long time over those political changes.
That was William Shimidas, Dean of the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. Today on Weird Science, Ryan Britton is here with a story about the 13-year cicada. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. So what's happening with cicadas?
Well, the southern cicadas are back, and they are emerging from 13 long years underground to procreate, make a lot of noise, and generally bother people across the southeastern United States.
So for people not familiar, these cicadas are these big winged insects with a wide body.
Correct.
And a very annoying sound.
Yep, and they're definitely big bugs for sure. They have these large translucent wings with veins that run across them. They have these big beady eyes. And like I said, they're big and they're a bit scary, but they are harmless. So what's weird and cool about cicadas is that they spend most of their life underground feeding off of tree sap. A lot of them spend a couple years underground before emerging to grow wings and mate. But here in the United States, we have two broods or groups of cicadas. One spends 13 years underground, and one spends 17 years underground before emerging. And these are called periodical cicadas. And as of a couple days ago, the cicadas on the 13-year cycle have emerged across the southern United States.
And that is weird. These cicadas rise from the soil every 13 years.
Correct. And it's a long time. We haven't seen this group since 1999. And scientists haven't quite figured out how all the cicadas know, in unison, when spring is 13 years later versus 14 years later or 12 years later. Hmm. But they think that this time spent underground is most likely a defense mechanism to thwart predators. Basically, what they want to do is outlive them. So they stay underground and live longer than any generation of predator that would like to eat them. So cicadas can't be part of a steady predator diet. Predators don't live long enough to remember them.
And then after these 13 years, they finally emerge.
Right. They fly around, make a ton of noise, and make millions and millions of babies, and then they die. But their emergence is unforgettable because they make so much noise, like this. So even after 13 years, people don't forget.
I'd like to forget quickly. Make it stop, please. So, Ryan, where can people find out more about the 13-year emergence of the cicada?
You can check out usatoday.com for an article. Also, there's a good video at the Tennessean, and that's at TENNESSEAN.com.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky is Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Animal behaviors in the everyday, each and every city, state, county, country, avenue, and driveway. Rational behaviors make the system tick, makes the human do the trick, earn the pay, procreate, and quick fade. Animal behaviors.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Beth Lebwohl joins us with a story on the science of looking at the big picture of how human population grows on the planet and what impact that has on the rest of the creatures that we share it with. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge. So this week I spoke to Dr. Christopher Small, who is a geophysicist at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. And he specializes in analyzing satellite data and actually nightlight data. That is data from our nightlights here on Earth. He told me where humans are living on Earth, big picture wise. And the first thing he said is, we're living near water.
Well, the most interesting, to me at least, is that humans occupy every type of environment on Earth, every climatic zone, but at global scales, we're very densely clustered, with most people living on just a few types of landscape, basically coastlines, deltas, and valleys.
Okay, so he establishes that, and then he sort of dispels the myth that we humans, now approaching a population of 7 billion on Earth, we're actually not running out of space.
Oh, right. And one way I've heard this described, in just how little space that humans actually take up in the world, is that you could put every human alive today inside the Grand Canyon. It might be a little uncomfortable, but you could do that.
I don't think it would be worse than a New York City subway ride, quite frankly.
There's a perception among many people that the world is overpopulated and that we're running out of space. And, well, the question of overpopulation is more opinion than anything else. But one thing we've been able to quantify is we are most definitely not running out of space. More than half the people in the world live on less than 3% of the inhabited land area. So that's the land area excluding Antarctica, Greenland, the ice sheets. Of the places people live, more than half of us are living on less than 3%. So there is a lot of open space left.
So Dr. Small is saying that humans aren't running out of space here on Earth.
Right, right, exactly. And then once we established that, we got a little bit more into the nitty-gritty of his research, which is that he uses census data and nightlight data to try to figure out the patterns of human development, which actually haven't been very thoroughly studied. We don't know exactly in what direction or how or where cities grow or why. Or how cities link up with one another and cross through rural areas. So that's what he tries to figure out.
One of the things we found from looking, from comparing the nightlights and the census data, is that cities all over the world are connected into these giant spatial networks that are linked together by agricultural areas and areas that are less densely populated. And these networks form a very specific pattern that we see all over the world. And this pattern is sometimes referred to as an emergent pattern, meaning that there's an order that wasn't imposed by anybody, but just emerged from the collective actions of everyone. It's sort of an analogy is when you look at a colony of ants. When you look at it from a distance, they're clearly engaged in doing things, they're cooperating, and yet there is no leader. The ants are acting individually, and yet a collective pattern emerges from that.
Okay, now why is this important, especially as it relates to biological diversity?
Because this pattern may give us the ability to make predictions about where development may occur, may be more likely to occur, and may give us a way to anticipate the potential impact of different types of development patterns and how these may impact natural ecosystems. A good example is in some countries in the tropics, conservationists look at natural habitats of animals that need to migrate through forests. And so if you break a big piece of forest into a number of smaller pieces, some animals can't survive in these smaller pieces because they need to move around. And so one thing they try to do in cases like this is they try and keep these forest patches connected so that the animals that need to move from one to another are still able to do it without having to cross through human-dominated areas.
So Beth, what's the takeaway message here on human population and biodiversity?
Bottom line is that humans are migrating at a very rapid rate to cities. And because of that, Dr. Small is trying to figure out the pattern of urban growth and also how urban areas connect with each other so that one day we might be able to predict their growth the way we predict the weather. And in so doing, we might be able to steer that growth in a way that is conducive to the livelihood of our animal friends.
Well, thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Ori.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and something amazing that anyone can see, what's called a green flash. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. The green flash is seen all over the world, and we hear from people, frequently people who are out in boats, because what you need to see a green flash is a very distant horizon. And so when you're in a boat on the ocean or on a huge lake, say one of the Great Lakes, you've got that far, flat horizon, and that's what's needed to see a green flash.
So what does it look like? What are people seeing?
Well, what happens is, in the last few moments before the sun disappears at sunset, so imagine you're out on your boat looking across this expanse of water and you're seeing a beautiful sunset, and just as the sun is sinking below the horizon, just at the very last moment before the sun disappears, instead of seeing a red color on the sun, you see a flash of the color green, and that's the green flash.
Wow. So can you explain for us why does the sun have this green flash, this very brief flash of green?
Well, this very beautiful phenomenon, this green flash, is really related to a very ordinary phenomenon that you might see if you put a ordinary spoon into a glass of water. If you do that, you're going to see that it's broken in two, and that is the effect of refraction. So the way I've heard this explained, and it's been explained in the book Light and Color in the Open Air, that's a classic book by M. Menard. In Light and Color in the Open Air, he explains that you can almost imagine that there are several images of the sun superimposed on each other, one slightly higher than the other. And the uppermost image of the sun is the color green. And again, we're talking not about the real sun, but about just images of the sun that appear to be split, caused by this effect of refraction. So you've got a red sun, and above that, an image of a green sun. And as the red sun disappears below the horizon, what's left is just that little rim of the image of the green sun, the green flash.
So, Deborah, what are some tips for people to be able to see the green flash?
Well, again, many people do see it over water, because when you're on the water, you have that very distant sea horizon and you have a very flat horizon. So a far horizon and a flat horizon at sunset are needed for the green flash. You could see this in the mountains. If you were up in the mountains and you had a very long view, that would be another good place to see it. But you do need a far view of the horizon, and you need a horizon that's unobstructed by trees or buildings or anything like that.
Well, thanks, Deborah. It's something to see in the global night sky during the day.
And you know, Jorge, they say that once you've seen a green flash, you'll never again go wrong in matters of the heart.
Oh. Okay, I'm going to be looking for it then.
Okay, Jorge, thank you.
Thanks, Deborah. Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Bright Light Social Hour, The Black and White Years, 100 Flowers, The Monahans, and The Boxing Lesson. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. To take you out, Cassiopeia, off the upcoming release From the Boxing Lesson.